For What's Universal Time, stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. An airstrike in the northern Syrian city of Aleppo has destroyed a hospital supported by the international charity Doctors Without Borders. Numerous people, including children, were killed. The fighting has left the country's ceasefire in shambles, with United Nations Special Envoy Stephane de Mistura saying a so-called cessation of hostilities agreement was barely alive. The chairman of the UN Human Rights Task Force in Syria, Jan Egeland, joined de Mistura in urging Russia and the U.S. to help end the violence.
No one doubted the severity of the situation, and now no one is now uncertain about the consequences. So what I'm saying is that the lifeline to hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people that have had hopes that things would really get better now, that lifeline may be broken.
Thursday's attack came amid a marked increase in violence in Aleppo, with nearly 200 people killed in the past week. Also Thursday, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry condemned the attack on the hospital. International monitors have told the UN Security Council violations of a tense ceasefire in eastern Ukraine between Kiev and Russian-backed rebels reached alarming numbers not seen in months, both sides blaming the other for the violations. South Sudan government and opposition officials say they are moving closer to forming a transitional government, which is now several months behind schedule. President Salva Kiir's spokesperson says the current cabinet will likely be dissolved any time now. This is VOA News. U.S. military has disciplined 16 military personnel, including a two-star general, for their role in last year's mistaken airstrike on a hospital in Afghanistan that left 42 dead. None of those punished face criminal charges, but in many cases, a non-judicial punishment, such as a letter of reprimand or suspension, can effectively end a military career. Airstrike occurred during an intense battle in Kunduz after Taliban militants seized the northern city. Austrian Parliament has approved Europe's strongest and strictest asylum laws in response to the migrant crisis on the continent. Legislation makes it more difficult for relatives of asylum seekers to join their family members in Austria. Opposition parties and rights groups have criticized the legislation. Austria received about 90,000 asylum requests in 2015, the second highest in the European Union on a per capita basis. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon on Thursday told Austria's lower house of parliament that increasing restrictions on migrants will negatively impact Europe's commitments to international law.
I welcome the open discussions in Europe, including in Austria, on integration. But I am alarmed again about growing xenophobia here and beyond.
Ban told the Australian lawmakers that under international European laws, they have a moral or legal principle obligation to help those fleeing war, human rights abuses, and persecution. U.S. Republican presidential frontrunner Donald Trump says Democratic Party frontrunner Hillary Clinton would have no chance as president, except that she is playing what he called the woman's card in hopes of becoming the first female U.S. president. Opinion polls show Clinton has nearly a 9% lead over Trump nationwide. The next key race for both candidates is next Tuesday, with Republican and Democratic Party primary elections in the states of Indiana. Trump campaigned there on Thursday.
With a long way to go, although we don't have a long way, if I can win in Indiana. If I win, we will. It's over. If we win in Indiana, it's over.
Meantime, Ted Cruz, whose chance of winning the Republican nomination rests mostly on hopes of a brokered convention in July, is getting strong opposition from a former Republican Party leader. Former House Speaker John Boehner described Cruz in profane terms, and I quote, calling him Lucifer in the flesh. Get more news at our website. You can find us at voanews.com.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
America. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, April 29th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Somali and African Union forces face a resurgent Al-Shabaab.
Al-Shabaab has changed strategically their operations from the face-to-face fight to target to the civilians, such as hotels, so they can terrorize the civilian population.
Abdi Hakim Mohamed Haji Fakih was Somalia's defense minister until 2014. Pro-democracy groups in Swaziland say no to three proposed amendments in parliament. An elephant anti-poaching summit has opened in Nairobi, Kenya, and we'll examine South Sudan's crumbling economy as the government and rebels move closer to forming a national unity government.
The president now is working on the process to dissolve the government in the running up to formation of the transitional government of national unity.
Attend is spokesman for South Sudan President Salva Kiir, and nearly 3 million Malawians are facing food shortages due to severe drought. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Terror group Islamic State claimed its first ever attack in Somalia earlier this week, though the claim has not been verified. Meanwhile, Al-Shabaab militants have stepped up their attacks as Somalia gears up for elections later this year. As Henry Richwell reports, there are growing frustrations among Somalia's Western backers over the country's slow progress in establishing its armed forces to bring security after 25 years of chaos.
Somali authorities say they are countering a resurgence from Al-Shabaab rebels after years of progress in driving back the militants. Abdi Hakim Mohamed Haji Fakih was the country's defense minister until 2014.
Al-Shabaab has changed strategically their operations from the face-to-face fight to target, you know, the military bases, or target to the civilians, such as hotels, so they can terrorize the civilian population.
That included a series of suicide attacks in recent weeks, many of them targeting government figures in the capital, Mogadishu. Analyst Kathy Henline of Britain's Royal United Services Institute says Al-Shabaab has been extending its reach across East Africa as it has lost territory in Somalia.
So we've seen it exert a much greater level of influence in Kenya, for example. There's much higher levels of recruitment and fundraising going on in Kenya.
Kenya recently marked the first anniversary of the Garissa University attack, when Al-Shabaab gunmen killed 148 people. Kenya is one of the main contributors to the African Union peacekeeping force, known as AMISOM. After initial territorial gains, Somali authorities say AMISOM forces have been largely confined to their barracks for the past year. Again, Kathy Henline.
It's having problems holding on to and establishing a presence in the territories that it has retaken. In Somalia especially, there is a suspicion about what troop-contributing countries are, what their interests are in the country, and that they may not be operating for the greater good of Somalia.
Somalia's Western backers, including the United States, have been effectively paying the wages of Somali government troops. The European Union recently cut the monthly stipend it pays to AMISOM soldiers. Former Defence Minister Abdi Hakim Mohamed Haji Fakih says it is vital the support continues.
They need support by the international community because the government is financially is not in a position to pay their salaries and to arm their military, and also to lift the arms embargo against the Somali National Army.
The United States has carried out a series of drone strikes against Al-Shabaab militants. The Somali government has welcomed the intervention and warns of a growing threat in the run-up to elections scheduled later this year. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Civil society and pro-democracy groups have called on Swaziland's parliamentarians to scrap debates on three proposed amendments, which they say would further erode the fundamental human rights of citizens in the Southern African Kingdom. Parliament is debating to amend the Public Order Act, the Professional Terrorism Act, and the Police Act, which mandates that anyone seeking to have a meeting must first get permission from the Commissioner of Police. Wandile Lululu, National Coordinator for the Swaziland United Democratic Front, tells reporter Peter Clotty that the proposed amendment will make things worse for the public.
This amendment, interestingly, doesn't change anything. In fact, it makes it even more difficult for civil society groupings to have meetings. For instance, if you are more than this amendment or proposal says, if you are to have more than 15 people meeting, for them to meet, they must have had a permission or a permit from the police commissioner. For you to get a permit, you must have declared the agenda of the meeting. And if the commissioner thinks and believes the agenda may pose a threat to national security, public order, and public interest, he has a right, according to this law, to stop the meeting.
Issues have also been raised about the Professional Terrorism Act. What is the concern here? And don't you think that the government needs this? Because concerns have been raised about terrorism activities all across the globe. So if there are ingrown domestic terrorists, shouldn't the government deal with them?
We believe it is too broad, making almost everything that may be deemed anti-government to be a terrorist act. For instance, this provision or this section says if you are wearing a T-shirt that may of an opposition, that may be viewed and taken as an act of terrorism. This is an abuse of the anti-terror treaty that the world has. And it is being used to deal with dissent in the context of Swaziland.
It's almost certain that Parliament will approve of these three bills and possibly signed by King Mswati, ostensibly making them laws of Swaziland. What is the next line of action for civil society groups or pro-democracy groups like you?
What we intend to do, this Sunday we are celebrating and commemorating the Workers' Day. Of all of us, led by workers, civil society and political parties, must educate and raise more awareness to the general public about the violations of our fundamental rights that these acts are going to come with. That's one. The second one, we will definitely in the very short while consider strategic litigation. But once these bills are acts, we may have to test them in a constitutional court.
Wandile Drudu is the national coordinator for the pro-democracy group Swaziland United Democratic Front. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Mbabane. South Sudan rival factions have taken another step closer towards forming a national unity government that will administer the country for the next 2.5 years before elections are held. As Wake Simon Wudu reports from Juba, presidential spokesman Aten Wek Aten says the current South Sudan cabinet will soon be dissolved.
President Salva Kiir's spokesman Aten Wek Aten says Mr. Kiir and First Vice President Riek Machar are finalizing consultations on a transitional government.
The president now is working on the process to dissolve the government in the running up to formation of the transitional government of national unity. There are a bit of consultation that are taking place between the parties and particularly the first vice president.
Attorney says Mr. Kiir is ready to name 16 ministerial positions for the transitional cabinet from his side. Parties to the August peace agreement are under pressure to quickly form a unity government as required by the peace agreement. SPLM-IO William Ezekiel says his side has finalized the consultations and nominations in a meeting yesterday run by Machar.
The agenda was to discuss the issue of the formation of the government of national unity, particularly in regard to the quota given to IO by virtue of the agreement, resolution of the conflict in South Sudan.
The SPLM-IO is allowed to name 10 ministerial positions. Ezekiel says officials examined the qualifications of each ministerial candidate during the meeting.
Of course, all of us, we agreed that the ministers of SPLM in a position, number one, they should get rid themselves of this issue of tribalism, this issue of nepotism, issue of regionalism and all sorts of schism. Then the criteria is as follows, that we need a competent cadre, person with a good qualification background, Not only that, a person who is entirely has the spirit of belonging to South Sudan, who is ready to serve the people of South Sudan, and above all, a candidate who believes in the principles and in the spirit of the agreement by itself.
Ezekiel says Machar submitted the list of SPLM-IO nominees to Mr. Kiir. Attorney says Mr. Kiir may dissolve the current government, quote, anytime now, but did not provide an actual date on which it would happen and a transitional government would be formed. The peace deal states that the transitional government will have 30 ministers. President Kiir will appoint 16, the SPLM-IO gets to name 10, and the former detainees and other opposition parties appoint 2 each. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wodo in Juba.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today's Friday, April 29th. And please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time, 16 minutes past the hour. 2.5 years of civil war have destroyed South Sudan's economy. The country's leaders say they need urgent international support to rebuild and restore peace. But as Jason Patinkin reports for VOA from Juba, that may be complicated.
When South Sudan gains independence in 2011, its oil wealth made its government one of the richest in East Africa. But now, after more than 2 years of war, it is among the poorest. Fighting has cut oil production by half, while crude prices worldwide have collapsed. The South Sudanese pound has lost almost 90% of its value, and inflation is skyrocketing. President Salva Kiir and former rebel leader Riek Machar are meant to form a transitional government this week aimed at ending the war, but there is not enough money to keep the new government going. Mariel Owau, an economics professor at the University of Juba, says the new government will need direct budget support to stay afloat.
We are in extraordinary conditions, abnormal conditions. Under the normal conditions, you leave a country to take care of its budget. But we are coming out of the war. We are settling people. We are setting up institutions. So it needs abnormal resources.
Kiir and Machar are asking the international community, including the International Monetary Fund, to help with such resources. Whether budget support arrives is partly the decision of foreign donors like the United States, Britain, and Norway. Those three countries say they will support the transitional government, but they are wary of corruption and funds being used to fuel more fighting. British Ambassador to South Sudan Tim Morris said foreign donors need to see big changes in how the country's finances are managed.
If this country is to attract a substantive international package, it has to implement policies of reform.
Morris says there will be no lump sums of cash given, and any spending must be tightly controlled. He warns that for the time being, Britain will not support the military, South Sudan's largest employer, given human rights abuses committed during the war. Morris also cautions that foreign nations are stretched insofar as how much money they can spend on South Sudan. South Sudan's finance minister, David Deng Atharbe, said he is confident the government will enact the reforms and win support.
The international community, especially the IMF and the World Bank, are ready to come and to plan programs for South Sudan. This, of course, is based on a number of conditions, but those conditions are good for us because all of us aspire to implement all those conditions they look for.
Yet South Sudanese economist Peter Biarajak is skeptical the country's politicians will do a better job managing finances this time around. He says the IMF may require an austerity budget that cuts spending by 50%. But, he says, South Sudan's public wage bill is actually expanding as Machar's politicians, generals, and soldiers rejoin the government and army. Whether or not Kiir and Machar prove him wrong may decide whether their new partnership succeeds or fails. Jason Patinkin for VOA News, Juba.
Kenya kicked off its high-level wildlife conservation summit called the Giants Club Summit with a field visit to the old Pajeta Conservancy, home of the last three northern white rhinos on Earth. Delegates and media learned about current technology, techniques to mitigate conflict between elephants and humans, and efforts to combat the poaching crisis across the continent. VOA's Jill Craig has more from Nanyuki in Kenya.
At a lodge beneath the shadows of Mount Kenya, the presidents of Kenya, Botswana, Gabon, and Uganda, as well as conservationists, business people, tourism operators, and global philanthropists, are meeting to discuss a problem devastating countries across Africa: the killing of tens of thousands of elephants every year to feed the illegal ivory trade. The three-day Giants Club Summit aims to find solutions to protect elephants and safeguard their landscapes. And so Old Pejeta, the largest black rhino sanctuary in East Africa, and a place that has quite a bit of experience with anti-poaching strategies, hosted a day of demonstrations and talks to help summit participants better understand the fight against poaching. Max Graham is the founder and CEO of Space for Giants, an elephant protection charity that provides technical advice to the Giants Club members and is supporting the summit. He says high-level governmental support is crucial to stop the poaching epidemic.
We haven't seen anything on the continent. We haven't seen in the continent dealing directly with this issue at this level of participation. And that's why it's worthwhile. The political will, and I say this again, if you have political will at the very top, everything else becomes easy.
According to Kenya's Cabinet Secretary for Tourism, Najib Balala, the tourism industry provides a strong incentive for African governments to protect their wildlife.
So yes, we care because it is important for our GDP.
Participants at the day's events watched a demonstration by Old Pejeta's rapid response team, showcasing how Kenyan police reservists with a tracker dog could land via helicopter at the scene of a crime and begin their work. They watched reenactments of human-elephant conflict, learned about the importance of judicial reform when it comes to prosecuting poachers, and also learned about the different types of fences and deterrents that are being used to stop elephants from crop raiding. Wayne Lauder is the co-director of a conservation NGO called PAMS Foundation, based in Tanzania, another country hard hit by the poaching crisis. He explains why he traveled to Kenya for this event.
Really an opportunity to come and network with other people, share best practice so we can learn from, you know, there's some good people here, and we can also share some of our experiences.
The participants, as well as English actress and model Elizabeth Hurley, also had the opportunity to meet Sudan, the last remaining male northern white rhino in the world, and a six-month-old white rhino calf named Ringo, who perhaps gives a glimmer of hope in this fight against poaching. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nanyuki, Kenya.
Nearly 3 million people in Malawi are facing food shortages as drought grips southern Africa. Southern Malawi has been hit particularly hard, and the government has declared a national disaster. Lamek Masina reports for VOA from Blantyre, where people are already feeling the impact.
Dry, scorched fields like this one have become a common sight in southern Malawi. Flash floods and dry spells caused by El Nino weather patterns hit the maize crop, leading to a deficit of about 1 million metric tons. This follows a disappointing harvest last year as well. Crops like potatoes and cassava proved more resilient.
We have long been relying on maize, but this year the crop did not do well. Now we are relying on these pigeon peas we believe will bail us out from hunger.
Families are having to find alternatives to the maize porridge they would normally eat.
Many days we eat pumpkins that we sometimes find in our failed maize field.
Food prices have gone up at the market. The price of maize has tripled.
We have to raise the prices because we have to transport it from farther away. But people are not buying. They don't have enough money.
Nearly half of Malawi's children were already chronically undernourished in 2014. Now 4% of children are suffering severe acute malnutrition, according to UNICEF. Water sources have also been affected.
Almost all the taps around our area have run dry. In most cases, we wake up around 2 a.m. to try to get water at the only kiosk.
The next harvest is 12 months away. About 2.8 million people already will need food aid into 2017, and aid agencies expect that number to balloon in the coming months. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we begin with volleyball. Egyptian defending champions Lahli edged Algeria's former Africa champions GS Petrole by 3-2 in the quarterfinals at the Africa Women's Volleyball Club Championships in the Tunisian capital Tunis on Thursday. Rwanda Revenue Authority dismissed Egypt's El Sham 3-1. Tunisia's Carthage beat Kenya Prisons 3-1, and Kenya Pipeline beat Tunisia's CS Faxian 3-1. Staying in Tunis, Rwanda Revenue Authority challenged El Ahli as Carthage face Kenya Pipeline in semifinal action today, Friday. In classification matches, Kenya Prisons play CS Faxian, El Sham engage GS Petrolia, Algeria's Machal Bejaia play Cameroon's FAP, Uganda's Ndeje University play Ghana Police, Cameroon's Ingies meet Algeria's Wilaya Bejaia, and Nigeria's Jos South encounter Cameroon's Bafia. In cricket, hosts Zimbabwe amassed 12 points to top the log at the double round-robin ICC Africa Women's 2020 World Cup qualifier in Harare. Kenya and Uganda tied on 6 points. However, Kenya is second on account of a better run average, while Tanzania finished fourth. Consequently, Zimbabwe progressed to the global qualifier for the 2018 ICC Women's 2020 World Cup. In athletics, Alhadi Lameche clocked 2 hours 17 minutes and 56 seconds at the Dusseldorf Marathon in Germany to become the second Algerian to qualify for the men's marathon at the Rio de Janeiro Olympics in August. He joins Hakim Sadi, who qualified at the Algiers International Marathon in the Algerian capital. In rugby, Samoa play Spain in the World Rugby Under-20 Trophy Final in Harare, Zimbabwe on Sunday. Earlier on in a day filled with rugby action, Namibia tackled Fiji in the bronze medal playoff. Uruguay meet the United States of America in the fifth place playoff as Zimbabwe take on Hong Kong in the seventh place playoff. In football, Nairobi's Kasarani Stadium is the only match venue Kenya has which meets the required standard for the 2018 Orange African Nations Championship. The CAF Vice President Elmani Kabala Kamara told the Nairobi media on Thursday. Kamara's remarks follows a 4-day inspection tour by CAF to stadiums in Kisumu, Meru, Machakos, Mombasa and Nairobi's Nyayo Stadium. Kenya has until September next year to get all facilities designated for the next African Nations Championship ready. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good weekend. We look forward to your report again on Monday morning. Here's our listener mail for this Friday morning, April 29th.
A call on President Muhammadu Buhari to do something quickly over the activities of Fulani herdsmen in Nigeria against innocent farmers or Nigerians. Because if he does not do something, the way it is going might result to certainly bad violence material, I mean, functions in Nigeria. Albert Alago, former Budukatu Ranch Bechi Reward, in Obaliko local government area of Kosova State, Nigeria. Thank you.
Well, thank you, listener, for your comment. And please send your viewpoints to DaybreakAfrica at voanews.com. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The United Nations Security Council removed a 12-year-old arms embargo on Ivory Coast on Thursday and renewed the UN peacekeeping mission in the country for another year. The embargo was imposed in 2004 after Ivory Coast 2002-2003 civil war. The resolution passed on a unanimous vote welcomes an ongoing dialogue among all Ivorian political parties and the improvement of the human rights situation. And that is it for this Friday, April 29th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Mark Oman, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm James Butte saying, have a good weekend.
Hi, I'm Susan Yawkey of VOA's International Edition. VOA's flagship global news program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. We have hundreds of reporters gathering the news and the views of some of the world's greatest experts on international issues. But you don't have to tune in at broadcast time. Listen when you want. Just go to voanews.com. Click the Programs tab and scroll down to International Edition.
Music time in Africa. Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in
feast your ears and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Friday at 0900 and Saturday and Sunday at 0900, 15, 20, and 2200 hours UTC. 200 hours UTC.